Better than ever.
Oh, look.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Professional Insight Podcast season. We're in season seven now, welcome all. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Brandon Curry. Where is the rest of this? Okay, here we go. Brandon Curry.
Josh Bond, still mourning over here, but shout out to our brother, Jeff Collins.
Yes, thank you very much, Bondo. And we have a great guest on with us today. Miss Laura Watts. How are we? How are you doing?
Great to be here today.
I'll just do a brief intro to yourself, and then you can take it from there. So Laura is the CEO of CanAge, Canada's National Seniors Advocacy Organization. You teach law at the University of Toronto, law and aging at the University of Toronto, and has worked as a lawyer defending the rights of older people. Ms. Watts is also a regular media guest and keynote speaker on aging issues, and you live in Toronto. So we have done a bunch of authors from your publisher.
All good except for living in Toronto so far.
Hey, I really am in Toronto sort of under protest. I moved for love from Vancouver, which is the only reason most people will move from Toronto. And I spend about half the year in Nova Scotia. So I'm pan-Canadian.
Okay.
Can we just touch on, are you a Leafs fan?
I can either confirm or deny. What I am is I'm a hockey fan. And I grew up in Niagara Falls.
You're a Canucks fan.
I grew up in Niagara Falls. So I grew up cheering, for Buffalo because that's where you
did.
Oh, and that's, we would go over the river, as we called it. And you could get tickets right behind the net for $10 or something like
crazy.
That. And then I moved to Vancouver. So of course we cheer for the Canucks, but I confess to you, I have a Tim Hortons jersey upstairs.
Nice.
Fair enough.
Hortons Leaf jersey then, evidently.
A Tim Hortons Leaf jersey, but remember, he played for Buffalo too.
He did. That's why he did.
But actually, my favorite hockey of all is women's Olympic hockey. That is for me the best hockey that you can get out there.
Yeah, I like having the hockey generally.
I agree with that.
But let's be honest, though, that professional women's hockey league, pretty good.
Oh, listen,
it's killing it.
I think it's fantastic. And I mean, the women out there who are just killing it on the ice, I think it's so exciting to see what's actually happening. I grew up at a time where, I'm 52. There was no hockey except for road hockey in front. I got my figure skating and I remember wanting to play hockey. And the answer was just, no. Even though, you play at your house, you play in your, whatever, but it's just no. So for me at this age, and I have, a daughter who's in her early 20s, who was kind of even just on that stage where we wanted her to play hockey. It was just kind of getting started, girls hockey. And now, maybe I'll get grandchildren and they'll be able to really enjoy it. But I think it's just transformative. And it's just the best brand of hockey out there right now.
I'm 48 and we'd always have the one or two girls that played on the boys team, right? But there was absolutely nothing for the collective, right? Which is, it's fantastic to see.
Those girls got punished, though. If not from the teammates, from other teams. That was the reality, right?
I would offer.
My sisters played.
I would offer kind of still is. But I mean, this is part of what we're talking about longevity and change. I actually was looking at the hockey gear downstairs because I am downsizing. I am doing that thing at 52 with my parents who are 87 and my kids who are in their early 20s. And I'm even we often call a sandwich generation, but actually, as I write in my book, you know, we're not in sandwiches anymore. We're in club sandwiches. We have six generations. We have six generations in active, right? I've been supporting just one example last week, an older man, he was in his mid 90s. He's supporting and making decisions for his son, who's 72, who has dementia. And wow. The son is 22. He is, 72. His kids are late 40s. And those kids have kids, you know, mid 20s. And he just had his first, you know, new one on that. So six generations right there. That's the norm now, right? That's where we are. My children today, who are 21, 22, and 23, can expect easily to live to 100. And that's not taking into account that my grandparents lived into their mid 90s. So genes and everything aside. So when we're thinking about longevity, we really have to think about it in this exciting, but also complex way. And we are not doing a very good job thinking about it just yet.
Which is what really intrigued me when your publisher reached out to us to interview. And obviously, because we're the Professional Insights podcast, loving having another professional on to talk about, you know, some serious issues and some, you know, I am a certified financial planner. We run into this all the time. So the book, everyone, is called Let's Talk About Aging Parents. It comes out April 30th. Mm-hmm. You can buy it on Amazon.
Anywhere your books are sold.
Anywhere your books are sold. So it's such a great, it's such, I'm so glad you wrote about the book. You wrote the book because the number one thing about financial planning that we say is you plan for the worst case scenario. You hope for the best. You don't plan for the best case scenario because that hardly ever happens. And what do I mean by a worst case scenario, which you talk about right in the beginning of your book in your foreword, which was written by, and I forget who it was written by, and I apologize.
Oh, Deb Whitman, who's the chief public policy officer of the AARP. Yeah.
And so she mentions that her friend's mother was walking her dog. She was in her mid 70s. She was healthy. She was fully independent. And a squirrel ran out in front of the dog, which was probably a bigger dog, chased after the squirrel and down she went, fractured her hip in four places. And then all of a sudden she now has a dependent mother that she then had to move from Washington State to Idaho to take care of. These are like the best case. If you're planning for the best case scenario, well, you're going to say, oh, my mom's going to live into her 80s, statistically 87, according to StatsCan. And everything, she has enough money, everything is going to be fine. And then this happens in her early 70s. And one of the toughest things I find when talking to now baby boomers, where the youngest baby boomer is 60, that's the last of the baby boomers. And the hardest part for them is A, letting go, and B, talking about their, I hate to say it, but they're aging. And what is that going to look like? And what is retirement going to look like? And so I want to first ask you, like, what sparked you, besides your role as the CEO at CanAge, which is a busy job to begin with? Why'd you write a bloody book? Like, what was the...
And in the middle of a pandemic on top of that, right? Like, where everyone, you know, everyone was in one way or the other. Everyone was either busier than they ever were or quieter than they ever were. And I was on the front lines with the seniors organization during a pandemic. I didn't take a day off in 2 years.
That's crazy.
And many, many other people were in the same situation, of course, not just me. But all of this to say, I was tired of saying to people, where's the book, right? Where's the handbook? There is lots when you're pregnant, right? The what to expect when you're expecting, or the girlfriend's guide to pregnancy, or all these other ones. For toddlers, there's ones for kids, there's ones for teens and spirited children and everything else. But as we talk about, those are actually short periods of time. We don't feel like it perhaps at the moment, but the toddler years are like 2 years, right? How many books do you have for toddlers? And when we're talking about aging parents, we're talking, you know, 20, 30, 40 years.
Absolutely.
Right. And there was really nothing there that synthesized what you need to know using the right medical information, the right legal information, but also really the tricks of the trade, how to have the conversation. So I teach at the University of Toronto, professor, but I'm a professor in the Faculty of Social Work, which is where the Department of Aging lives. I'm cross-appointed to other areas as well, but I don't teach in the Faculty of Law, even though I am a lawyer. And that's because most of the problems aren't law problems. They're people problems. Mm-hmm. And there's coping problems. And there's, you know, comprehension problems. I sit as a member of the board of the Canadian Investment Regulatory Organization and a number of other regulators as well. It's not really that it's a money problem. It's not even that it's really a financial literacy problem, although all of those things can be true. Don't get me wrong. It's just that we're not asking the right questions and we're not planning necessarily for what people are expecting. And even financial planners who don't have that opportunity yet to really think about longevity economies, trying to make those decisions based on actually what intergenerational transfers of wealth look like now, which is very different than it looked like 5 or 10 years ago when they may have gone to school. And the expectations for age are usually outdated as well, right? So we're not using the right information. So what made me write the book? I got tired of saying I need to be able to have a book to hand to people. And I wanted it to be funny and not scary. I wanted it to be something approachable and witty, but also really useful. So if you're worried about cognitive impairment, you'll see that there's a chapter on dementia, yes, but there's a whole chapter before that on all the other things that's not dementia that it probably is. Like delirium, like you could have a urinary tract infection, like they could have too much vitamins in their system, they could have medication interactions and so on. So why did I do it? I just wanted people to have the right information at the right time to do things better.
Nice.
And you know, I know Bondo, you have some legal questions too that you wanted to kind of chat about. But no, you bring up some really great points. It was just actually like people don't want to talk about their demise, their eventual demise. Like, there's a saying, now we have the two certainties in life are death and taxes, right? But that is, like a tongue in cheek kind of a thing. But at the end of the day, you also, there's retirement. And what does that look like? And there's getting old and you're not going to be able to live in that family home for the rest of your life. And what does that look like? And you address all of those in the books. And you also at the very end of the book, I like the nuclear approach, when I was reading it, I had a little chuckle because you don't know me personally, but basically my way of doing with everything is the nuclear approach. And just blow everything up because, rip the Band-Aid off, right? But you brought up some really good, you recommend, hey, like try a family meeting, try even taking their driver's license away. And, these are the things that kind of force them to stop and to take notice, right?
Just building on that, I think what's really important is people actually don't know how to have a conversation. I mean, it sounds surprising to say, but fundamentally, we don't know how to have conversations with people. And there's also a lot of tropes, which are simply not true, right? Oh, there's going to be a silver tsunami. No, there's not. It's just we're living longer. There's no tsunami, right? It's fine, actually. We are going to have a massive intergenerational transfers of wealth and everyone's going to get lots of money. Well, okay, we are going to have a massive intergenerational transfer of wealth. That is true. In Canada, as I say, we're several years into $1 trillion with a T of intergenerational transfers of wealth. But most people didn't plan for this longevity. So the expectations are often not quite in line with needs. So just to kind of give you a sense, but the cheapest I've ever heard of, if you say you want 24-hour, live-in care, and I'm not talking about with a nurse, I'm just talking about really kind of anybody who's had any training whatsoever, someone perhaps like a healthcare aide or a personal support worker, the cheapest I've ever heard is $100,000 a year. And it's typically, we quote, we quote about $300,000 a year. And if you're looking at paying privately for something like a retirement home, and of course, this is funded differently in different parts of the country, you know, you're starting at many thousands of dollars. And the answer for how much that is, you know, you could spend $15,000, no problem, if you were layering on many different kinds of services. And then we think somehow that in Canada, aging is free, and it's not free. And so then people say, well, why don't you just sell the family home? Which, of course, is a facile answer, because actually there's nowhere to move to. Rental usually costs more than housing. If you're getting tax deferrals, you're getting it if you're a property owner. You're not getting it if you're a renter. And most places that you're renting are not age-friendly or age-inclusive. And so we have people who may have accumulated wealth in a family home, but actually it's the only thing keeping them connected to their community. So we're thinking about these kinds of ideas, but we actually don't have the right frameworks and the right answers. And what that leads to is conflict. So we're not actually taking care of our aging parents as if they are our children. That's the trope that makes me crazy. No, at no point do they become our children. They are always our parents. And you know, one of the best ways to get them to do something, ask them advice. They love to give advice, right? You want to know about what it's going to be like, how they're feeling about, you know, financial planning or wills and estates or any of those types of things. You know, I'm 52, sit on the bar stool, talk to my 87-year-old parents and say, hey, you know, kids are getting older. We're starting to think about making some changes. You know, I'm going to, I guess I got to rethink some stuff. I did my wills and powers of attorney, fill in the blank, X numbers of years ago, if I have them at all. I do, by the way.
You should hope so.
I do, by the way. You know, I just wondered, yeah, do you have any advice on that? Like, you know, have you thought about it recently? No? Yes? Oh, yeah. Oh, really? You do have your wills? Oh, great. You know, is there someone who's in charge of that? Am I? Oh, no, I'm appointed? Oh, yeah, maybe I should get a copy of that. Oh, we're going to look at it together. Oh, it's appointing my, you know, cousin who died 3 years ago as co-executor. Oh, so God. These are an opportunity to open them up as opposed to yelling at people. So I always talk about the binary. Don't rock in and tell everyone what to do. That's not going to work. Good luck on it. And don't avoid it either. So the book has scripts. It has ways of kind of laughingly assessing who your family is. And remember, not everyone has Leave It to Beaver. That's dating me. Or, you know, a family that looks like a TV sitcom. They're complicated. And we need to call that out.
You know, I always say, you know, back in the day, especially with the rules changing in the province of Ontario, specifically around executor rights and executor responsibilities, before it was an honor to be named an executor. And now if you're named an executor, you go, what did I do to you in your life? Like, what? Why do you hate me? Like, it is so convoluted. The legal requirements on an executor nowadays is through the roof.
Well, it's true. And also for, you know, substitute decision making, which is, you know, at least when you're dead, you stay dead, right? When it comes to mental capacity, it can fluctuate. And so you could be a substitute decision maker either for, you're in Ontario, so I'll use the words personal care. But if you're listening from BC, it would be a representation agreement. If you're looking from Nova Scotia, it'd be a healthcare directive. Same kind of thing, substitute decision-making document, and
health,
you can be doing
right?
it for property as well. And the reality of circumstances, yeah, you can be in and out. And so one of the key challenges is, okay, how do I do this, but also live my life? And also, you know, could somebody else do this professionally? Well, you know, in Canada, not for health and personal care decisions. You can hire, you know, an executor. If your dad is a professional trustee, you can do it for your finance in some circumstances that may be a fit for you. Some circumstances it may not be. But unlike the US, you can't actually hire someone to make your decision. So you have to find someone who's willing to do it. And as you say, it cannot be so much of an honor as it is a real worry. Also, we don't teach you what to do. And if you do it wrong, you can get arrested or held up in, you know, in civil court as well. Stakes are
high. Well, that's one of the reasons why I got my CEA designation, so we could advise clients. Complimentary who are you know with when they become executors, because to your point, they don't know.
No,
they have no idea. They just get told, because no one wants to talk about anything. You know, they just don't want to have that family meeting. So I'm so glad you brought that up in the book. It's like, have a family meeting. The other thing is, your debt is great, actually. being dead is not a problem. Being in a long-term care home will financially can financially ruin you. If you want to speak about that.
Yeah. And so what's really important to remember is you probably won't, right? So only about 5% of Canadian seniors will ever end up in either a retirement home or long-term care. So it's a very small percentage of people, but only 5%. But that 5% is getting bigger, right? The number of people in that 5% is increasing. We're in the province of Ontario right now. Formally, they've announced that the waiting list for long-term care, which is that publicly funded healthcare, it's not privately, but publicly funded healthcare. The formal waiting list is 43,000 people. The informal waiting list is well north of 50,000 people. If you're waiting for home care, publicly funded home care, these are people who've already been approved through the healthcare system. They're just waiting. So people to come to your house to help you with some needed healthcare, there's 6,000 people formally on the waiting list for home care in Ontario. There's more than that in reality. And this in-between thing called retirement home is an entirely private pay system. And, you know, it's that that's so expensive. If you can't afford long-term care, the healthcare part, you would pay that accommodation fee. But if you can't in Ontario, they can't, you can't get it out of it. It's not blood from a stone, right? So you will never be thrown out in Ontario. Well, that's not necessarily true in other jurisdictions. In New Brunswick, you know, you can be evicted from long-term care. So it's different in different places. The problem is that home care is expensive and you're probably going to have to pay for it yourself or find people, which is kind of why I wrote the book, to help you with it, or retirement homes, which are you know, expensive to begin with in terms of accommodation. And then you're paying for all of the care, even though in theory you could be getting that home care as well. The reality of circumstances, the average age in a retirement home is 3 years older than long-term care. So long-term care average age is 83 in Ontario. Average age for retirement home is 86, and people are increasingly frail. So we are not prepared for that at all.
What about a transitional living environment, right? What do you think of that? Because I mean, it's a concept that I never really directed my mind to. I mean, up north, maybe 10, 15 years ago, somebody had converted the old hospital into a transitional living. I was like, shit, that's smart, right? Like, you know what I mean? Because there's a retirement component to it, but then there was a section of it which was transitional living, right? So, I mean, it was, you know, there's restaurant and you know what I mean? They've got their own, you know, apartment or condo, however it was structured, right? And
I think it's really exciting is what's happening actually with the housing. And, you know, yes, we know housing is very expensive. There's no question about that. And rental housing is very expensive. Mm-hmm. And age inclusive or age accessible housing is faintingly small, right? This is one of the areas that we haven't done a very good job of, is making aging in place good. What's great, Josh, about what you're talking about is that integrated kind of connection. People say, oh, I'm going to retire to the cottage. I'm like, oh, don't retire to the cottage. What you want to do is retire to a place with a drugstore downstairs. You know, around the corner, there should be a grocery store. You should have a community theater around the corner as well. What you need to have is integrated living. And people are getting really interested in how to do that, both affordably, but also to keep people connected. That is the key. So co-housing, think about Golden Girls. That's becoming a big trend.
Really, eh?
Friends getting together and buying or renting a place together, which they can afford a beautiful place if they're all putting up. And often coordinating care at the same time. So we'll have one care worker come in, very effective, very efficient, and they can support all of them. Maybe they share a kitchen or they have different kitchenettes. We're seeing great intergenerational housing trends. This is fantastic. So organizations like Canada Home Share match graduate students typically with older adults for very affordable rent for the younger person and a little bit of help around the house for the older adults. So, you know, you get an incredible place to live, new relationships come. And what's most important of all is not only just that small income stream, which can make a huge difference for people, but what's also important to know is that we're addressing that loneliness, and we have an epidemic of loneliness in this country. We have an epidemic in not just Canada, but also in this country. And when I say loneliness is bad for you, it's as bad as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. It takes 8 years off your life. It reduces grip strength. It increases your chances of getting cognitive impairment and even makes you less stable on your feet and more prone to falling. So if I was trying to think about like one of the reasons I wrote Let's Talk About Aging Parents is we might spend all of our time thinking about, I don't know, tax implications, which we should. That's a very important thing we should think about. Absolutely.
We're talking about that next.
But we should also be thinking about how do we keep people connected and in communities. And we need to do that in a purposeful way, not just kind of hope it all works out.
Now, as a possible segue, what are your thoughts on the direction that our housing is taking and the possibility of us kind of mimicking, because you don't see it very often here, but us mimicking more of the European style of multiple generation within the same household?
Oh, I think we're already doing it. And it's just not been a thing that we've talked about very much, right? We have narratives around like failure to launch. We have narratives around I'm taking care of mom, right? And the narratives are interesting. And I think we have to ask ourselves, why do we have those narratives? But I mean, if we're just thinking about things like lane housing, it's superb. I don't really love the term granny flats, but we get the idea also of putting in a main floor as well. I mean, younger people today actually mostly can't afford to buy a place. And so co-purchasing is a great way of thinking about it. I was talking with some folks not too long ago who they did a new build. They purpose built a lovely home in a very advantageous neighborhood. They had three floors. Mom was on the main floor and aging in place. They had a lovely couple upstairs and they had a nice relationship, but they're separate units in a place that wasn't an apartment building. It was just built intergenerationally. And they had folks in the basement but it was a very attractive basement. We had some younger people there as well. So they had this nice feeling, this nice sort of connectivity. We had some social inclusion and mingling happening in the backyard, and the adult children, as we might call them, the folks in their middle ages, built purpose-built new lane housing as they were allowed to, and were living in a completely separate home, but on the same property. That is a very effective way of having housing, tax support, thinking about paying and mortgaging. Like, they did a really good job on it. We're doing that more and more, and I think that that's what's going to be happening as the pressures are increasing.
And you got the social aspect as well, right? Which is like you've said, it's key, right? It's key, right? We're social, generally speaking, social beings, right? So
we are. Well, let's think back about how well we all did emotionally and psychologically during the pandemic. Yeah. I mean, even my husband, who's a real introvert, at a certain point was like, okay, I've had enough. I'd like to talk to somebody now as well. But these kinds of decisions mean that we ourselves need to be thinking about it. That's kind of why I wrote the book. But we also need our systems to think about it better, right? We need the building codes to be more inclusive building. We know what they need to do. We just need to do it. And frankly, smaller doors have been used. And we know that bigger doors makes things accessible. And if you just increased it by X number of centimeters, we already know how many that is, then people could stay in their own houses longer. Like, it's some of these small pieces that I can't force building codes to change. Well, I do actually at CanAge, but we try to do those types of things. You know, making sure that vaccines are publicly funded and available. Can you imagine how we would have been if people had different rules about who could get COVID-19 vaccines and you had to pay for it individually? Like, it baffles. And yet, pneumonia vaccines are different. High-dose flu vaccines are different. What's covered? Shingles vaccines are different. So we need to start taking seriously what it means to stay healthy and well, because without health, you don't have wealth, and vice versa as well. And those things have to go together.
To touch on the estate piece, because part two of your book, you do address the power of attorney and the importance, and then the stat that I'm on a call with a home builder and two lawyers. So I know you guys know the stats, but 25% of Canadians don't even have a will. 50% don't have a power of attorney, which is the scary part, because that's when your loved one does not have the mental capacity or the faculties to make these decisions.
It's actually 2/3 and don't have a POA. It's worse than that.
2/3? It's 66% now. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for updating me. When I was when I took my CFP, the number that was quoted was 50%, but that was a couple years ago. So now, On that, obviously, notwithstanding the importance of getting a will and a power of attorney and going through a bloody lawyer, doing the at-home legal will kit, which is getting destroyed right now in the courts.
You can get it on Amazon for $23.99.
That having been said, I'd rather you do that than nothing, right? Because, I mean, I'd rather
and you that's have, a valid point.
As long as you, follow certain parameters, right? It's an expression of someone's interest, but you should, for the cost of it, you should consult a lawyer, right? Because there's important things to,
absolutely
to be addressed there.
Now, the piece on the power of attorney piece, which was very key, especially the power of attorney of property, it was key because we're seeing now trusted contact persons are being integrated in all of our files now. That when we talk to somebody, because the elder abuse that is happening is skyrocketing. So do you want to touch on that and the importance of having a power of attorney? And when talking to, you know, a financial advisor or a certified financial planner, making sure that you are, there's a trusted contact person there and the importance.
So this is where you got to take a deep breath and remember that I do believe that people are fundamentally good, but on the other hand, these numbers will make you question that. So 1 in 6 seniors will be abused in Canada and globally.
Physically or financially or both?
Well, what we know is that 1 in 6 older adults will be abused in one of the different kinds of abuse, right? Which will be profound psychological or emotional abuse. Not saying like, hey, mom, you know, you look fat at that. I'm talking about profound abuse.
Yeah.
Financial abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, institutionalized abuse, and denial of basic rights, right? So 1 in 6. In the pandemic, initial indicators were we went up within the first couple of months by about 250% in the first few months of the pandemic. And new indicators say that it was more like now, we think it was more like 600% increase in elder abuse and neglect. The federal government gave hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, quite rightly, to organizations supporting victims of domestic violence and intimate partner violence. Good. Hundreds and hundreds of million dollars to at-risk child and youth. Good. And $0 to elder abuse. There's little like sprinkling of bits of money, like, you know, chair yoga classes and so on through the New Horizons for Seniors grant, which are great, don't get me wrong, but they weren't activated at the time, right? Because the pandemic. But when I say there's always money for things we care about, it's important to know that those numbers don't lie. And those numbers are almost faintingly small in the area of abuse and neglect. And yet, the U.S. just put together a very reliable study of only financial exploitation. Okay, so we're not talking about all the other kinds of abuse, only financial exploitation. It's the first really good study with methodology that holds up. And they found that about $28.3 billion a year were taken from older adults in the United States. The numbers could be extrapolated backward at a 10x, right? They really can. They're very good numbers. And even if you want to be more conservative than $2.83 billion a year, feel free, be more conservative than that. We're still in the billions. So when I say that this is an important issue, I really mean that this is an important issue. Trusted contact persons are part of that. And so we were advocating for a long time that when you are look on an investment account, or even something that looks a lot like an investment account, because these days some things like insurance can look a lot like investments to me, and sometimes you get dual registrants and so on and so forth, that now the regulators require that you annually ask for a trusted contact person. And what we're trying to help support the sector do is, how do you have those conversations? Because many financial advisors don't have Brandon's skill or Trevor's skill and lawyers with Josh's skill as well. They don't really even know how to talk about it as well. They're there because they're numbers people, or they're there because they're planning people, but they're not there because they really feel like they're comfortable talking about a dementia or a potential abuse situation. So we're trying to help support and develop, how do you actually have those? A trusted contact person doesn't make decisions for you. That's important to remember, okay? I always say, you know, think of it when you had to sign a form for your kid's school about who to contact in the case of emergency. It's much more like that. Some large financial institutions had them already in there by contract, but this is now the regulator saying, no, we have to have it. people then say, well, if I have a substitute decision maker, if I have a power of attorney appointed, should it be the same person? Should it be a different person? That depends. I mean, the reality of circumstances, there's no one easy answer. There's part of me that really likes the idea of having someone else, not just because the person who's the attorney may be the abuser and has essentially unchecked powers until someone starts really looking, but also just because they may be, I don't know, on the same vacation as you, right? Many of us appoint the people who are closest to us.
Yep.
My husband's my attorney. And then, you know, after that, we go down the list. And so sometimes it's helpful to have somebody who's not going to be traveling with you as your trusted contact person. But again, it's up to you. Do you have to give one? No, you don't have to. You can tell people, you know what, in case of emergency or in case of a concern about health or in case of concern about exploitation, don't actually. Okay. But it's a helpful thing to have. Most importantly, advisors need to be able to have a skillful conversation. And I don't think we're quite there yet.
You know what? You're preaching to the converted right now. I mean, I thank you, because the amount of conversations I have with people, because you know, everyone thinks it's not going to happen to them until it does. I did not know 1 in 6. That's fairly high. I did not know $2.8 million in the, that's insane. But to be fair, that it's sad that it's that high, but that doesn't really shock me, because some of the stuff that we've seen, and people need to understand, if that POA of property is in place,
sure,
there is nothing I can do. There's nothing I can do. Be they have full legal rights over your financials. I mean, you even have to do, you know, this is why when it comes to the POA that I want you to deal with a lawyer, because they take you through the different types of POA. There's limited POA, there's just for profit, and you need to make sure that you're dealing with somebody that is competent and also has your best interest at heart, because we've also had experiences where, you know, where it's basically unfeathered, you know, POA for property, and you know that person leaves the country on a vacation, and their house is sold, right? Like done. Like it's and there's nothing that they can do about it. And right, these are worst case scenarios, but this is what happens.
Yeah. So some of the things that we're trying to do is also help clients, customers, Canadians, whichever they are. Sometimes they're all of those things. And whoever needs the decision, it could be a financial institution, it could be insurance, it could be whatever it is, whoever that third party is. We're trying to help them get the understanding that if things are at a fairly high risk, i.e. they're selling your house, that these days there's going to be some checks and balances on it. You can't pick up your phone these days without getting an alert. Most of them are fraudulent, but some of them are actually from your financial institution saying, hey, you're not where you're usually spending money. You know, we put a hold, go into your own app or whatever and release it if you are not concerned about this spending.
I just literally got one throughout the course of this podcast from Scotia.
Right. But we're more used to that now, right? It didn't used to be that case. And you know what, many people think that, oh, you know, older people don't use technology. It's actually nonsense. 87% of all Canadian seniors up to 85 use the internet every single day and have on average 5 internet connected devices. And now people over the age of 85, the savvy is increasing, and the pandemic made huge savvy as well. So they're usually shopping. They're on, you know, whatever social media the grandkids are on, or at least they're on the social media that the grandchildren have got profiles that they're willing to share on, whichever these things are, right? So these old ideas that, you know, older people can't use technology is just nonsense. So to get an alert like that would make sense. So we're trying to support the institutions to say, you know what, you actually have some obligations. It's just not unfettered commerce anymore. And hey, person who is using the power of attorney document, you might be on a spectrum of innocent, you don't know what you're doing because you spend most of your life as a teacher, as an auto mechanic worker, as a whatever it is that you do. You're not spending your time. Maybe you've never done this before. You don't know that you have to keep everything separate. You're not aware of trust accounting. Oh, right? And so you're just trying to do the right thing, but you kind of got mixed up and you're trying to do something and you want to avoid an argument with your mom. So you're trying to do something right there, right up to pure malfeasance, right? There's a whole spectrum in that regard. Yeah. So the idea of having a trusted contact person and the idea also of a third party saying, okay, yes, it's not that I won't recognize your power of attorney document. I'm not saying that. But if you're expecting to withdraw significant assets or transfer something, we're going to take some steps and we're going to actually have the obligation to check with a mentally capable person first. And that is a bit of a, oh, really? Because financial institutions and other third parties would say, well, I actually don't recognize that, you know, I can't do anything, which is the wrong answer, versus, sure, I'll do anything you want. That's also the wrong answer. They actually have some obligations. So we're working with the sector right now to help them understand what those obligations are and how to navigate them in a commercially effective way.
But in those instances, so, they just get independent lending institutions, creditor, like banks and such, cover their butt just by getting an independent legal advice. Yeah, great. We've got the power of attorney. We've got this. But you know what? Just to cover our butt, here, Mrs. Smith, go get independent legal advice, and they feel that's enough.
Yeah, well, the ILA issue is a real one, and I'm not sure it's ever been particularly useful. All the research I've ever seen on independent legal advice is problematic. If you're a person who's already being subjected to undue influence, being sent for independent legal advice with like the bad sun hiding behind the palm tree isn't really going to help because, you know, when you leave the office, he's still there under the palm tree, grabbing mom's arm and making her do it. And so the idea of true independence, you have to ask yourself, if the person is under undue influence and they've already been conned or they've been guilted or whatever else, now people have the right to make their own bad decisions, but is it truly independent? I don't know. And when ILA happens, it's so far down the pipeline, typically, that, you know, things are pressured. What I would offer is if you do have a power of attorney document that either is in play, it's been, it's a continuing one, or as we call it in the rest of the country, an enduring power of attorney. Americans would call it mostly a durable power of attorney, active right away and continues on past the point of incapacity. It doesn't let folks off the hook from checking in with the mentally capable person if you want me to do it. I sent my husband to renew my parking pass during the pandemic with my power of attorney. I did not get a call because he was paying for something, right? I sent him off to do something and transfer money from one place to the other with my power of attorney document. The financial institution called me and say, hey, you've got a person here. He says it's your husband and he's got are you okay with me doing that? Yes, because it prejudices me if he withdoes it. So I think an evolving understanding of the obligation of third parties to make sure and check in is being facilitated by good technology now.
I think there's your husband, and probably you're going to dread me to say this. There's got to be a sequel to this. And it's got to focus on the financial implications of how a health scare, for example, or an unplanned, which it happens to quite a lot of people, will financially ruin you. It will financially ruin your, you know, like you said earlier in the podcast, you were like, well, being dead is permanent. That's not what drains the resources. It's going to a long-term care home. And then the other thing that I know you know, but that a lot of people don't know, and we like to remind everyone when we sit there, is like, hey, this free long-term care homes or the publicly funded long-term care homes, you have to rank them. And if none of them are available, they get to put you wherever there is a space. So if it's 45 minutes to an hour and a half away, that's where mom and dad are going because that's the one that you want. Versus if it's private, you have that ability. And do you have the same, like, people are shocked by that. And, you know, you touched on the waiting lists. So that I think might be a sequel to your book.
Well, I've already started writing the next one. It's about it's a 6-book series. So the next one's already happening. When we're thinking about it, I usually hold up my hands when I try to explain the very complicated ways that we think about health and housing coming together for vulnerable people, right? Hold up my right hand. I say, okay, this is publicly funded healthcare. If you're in Ontario, you need your OHIP card. If you're in BC, you need your BC Care card, whatever that one is, you need that card, right? And if you can't afford to pay the housing additional part, which is usually a few $1,000 a month, it's often up to say $3,500 and often doesn't include extra things that you quite rightly need. You probably need someone to sit by the bedside that you may need to pay for privately at a practical level. You probably need to purchase more incontinent products because they're really expensive and long-term care homes often don't change people fast enough, right? So even though it looks like it's really inexpensive in the sense that people say, well, how could it be expensive? It's part of our healthcare system. No, there are actual all of these costs that you say. And then you've got to think about parking and you got to go visit. You've got all these extra costs as well. But to be fair, if you cannot afford to pay, those costs are put away. Now they may come at them at the estate at the end of it, but you will not get thrown out and you will not be denied long-term care. And long-term care, the way that the system works in Ontario, and I can speak about in other jurisdictions as well, is very confusing, right? So you once you're assessed, you can rank up to 5 that you want. And that's all very well and good. And you think to yourself, great. And there's waiting lists and you can measure off. If one of your 5 choices comes up, you're offered it often 24 hours to make a decision. And if you take it, and okay, you go into that one. If you don't take it, you are dropped to the very bottom of the list. And essentially these numbers, you're never going to get it again, right? Okay, that sounds kind of uncomfortable, but wait, there's worse. So in Ontario, there's passed something called Bill 7. And this will go to the Supreme Court of Canada because I can't imagine how it's legal, actually. And what they've done is they have now empowered essentially hospital CEOs and their discharge planners to put you
anywhere
in Southern Ontario, up to 70 kilometers away and up to 150 kilometers in Northern Ontario. So Josh Timmins would be one of those areas where you could have someone put 150 kilometers away,
which is insane,
which means for many people, they will never see their loved ones again because
that's a couple hours away, right? Like,
well, to be fair,
it's not possible.
To be fair, just in the Niagara Health System, right here, 25% of beds are taken up by seniors that have no place to go. People just drop them off. So it's just, and they're just tacking on to the OHIP bill. So
now is the fear of expanding this that we're dealing with the baby boom. So we don't want to put that much infrastructure in place to then,
No, we're so far behind. In fact, the millennials are bigger than the
Really? I didn't know that.
The Gen X generation, we're going to be on average 6 older people in our lives. The reason why I wrote the book is this, like our systems aren't built for this and our systems are not going to be functional in the way that we think they are. We built our healthcare system to fix broken legs and stop heart attacks. And you know what? Does it really still pretty well. If you have a broken leg and a heart attack, you can get rocked over to the ER. If you're really in need, they will treat you fast and you will get out. Like that's what we built the system for. When we built the Canada Health Act, the average age of death was 76. So people say, well, why isn't like home care and long-term care and this sort of retirement stuff in the middle, why isn't it part of it? It's because people didn't need it because we just died. When we created the CPP, it was done at a time where, you qualify at 65 and you die at 67. So the expectation was you would work your entire life, have 2 years and die suddenly. Right. And so I wrote, let's talk about aging parents because that is the system we have. We're never going to quite get caught up, which is fine in the sense that I can't change that tomorrow. It takes 4 years to build a nurse and, personal support workers rotate through our systems every 18 months because the jobs are so hard. We need to fundamentally think on our system level what we're doing. But at a pragmatic level, like my dad's back just went out. I'm going home tonight to Niagara because everything that was on the agenda for the next month is now changed. And that's just happened in the last hour. And that is our expectation. So we need to be figuring out amongst ourselves. When I say parents and adult children, I really mean anybody in our circles. It doesn't have to be biologically related. It could be whatever you want. And we need to figure out how to make things support ourselves in a way that doesn't necessarily hope and expect that some other person's going to do it for us. We need to save that for the broken legs and the heart attacks.
You got to pay the PSWs more, though, too. Oh, it's inevitable.
Really do. Absolutely.
It's inevitable.
Absolutely. Yeah. When
the server's getting paid $17.25 an hour and a PSW is getting paid $20.
And what I would just offer, you know, we can do better. We know how to do better. We just haven't done better. And mostly we haven't done better because we don't like older adults. And so as we're confronting our own longevity, I think reframing that is important. And I'll just let you know that it's interesting. The research on what someone thinks is old is pretty consistent. Doesn't matter how old you are. Old is between 20 and 25 years older than that. So if you're 5,
yeah,
25 to 30 is really old.
Makes sense, right? Because I remember sitting in the bar when I turned 19 years old and there being like maybe a 40-year-old. And I'd be like, man, that's old, right? Like...
That's a really old guy, she says.
No, 40's not old. Right?
Not at all. But, you know, when we talk about, you know, 70 is the new 40 or the new 50, in many ways it's true because we can live much healthier. We are living much longer, but what we don't have in our minds are frailty. And we just talked about that. Frailty can happen in so many different ways and can happen very suddenly. And so when I was writing the book, part of what I gave is little scripts for how to open some of these conversations, not, you know, saying, you know, you should do this and whatever else, but different ways into starting a conversation that people find already uncomfortable talking about money and health and death and, you know, family relationships. And what if the parents are toxic? What if you actually really dislike each other? And, you know, what if you got mental health and addictions and that just makes you normal, right? So we actually need to deal with not what people should do, but support the capacity of regular people to manage our own and our own family's longevity as well as we can.
That was something I was kind of intrigued in. Sorry, just about the toxicity of a parent, right? Like, how do you really address those situations, right? Like, example of somebody that their mother had some medical issues. They've never had a great relationship with their mother to begin with. Mother has medical issues, ends up having an aneurysm rupture, and now became very dependent, but it's that toxic relationship. How do you overcome that, right? Like, you get to that point where it's like, okay, I'm kind of stuck being here for you, but do I want to be here for you? No. What do you, like, yeah, that's one of those things I just don't know how to.
Yeah.
I can't wrap my head around it. So I couldn't imagine being in that
whole section called "What do you do if your parent is toxic?" And that is because lots of people have terrible relationships with the family members. And we used to have a situation where you'd have, you know, 4 to 5, 6 kids for 2. And if one didn't have a good relationship, that one kind of went away. It's okay. We got another 4 or 5 kids to deal with, and, you know, we'll manage. Well, you know what? Dad like you best. When dad's bad, you can take over. Like, you can take over with that. I'll do mom. You guys have always butted heads. It's okay, right? We had that. But now we have what's called the dependency ratio, which is a terrible name for it. But the dependency ratio, how many people are supporting other people, is kind of what the ratio is. And the dependency ratio, as I say, it used to be sort of like, you know, 1 to 3, 1 to 4, right? Lots of people to support you. And if you're 2 people and you've got 5 kids, that's lots of people. Then there's nieces and nephews and neighbors and stuff. And you're doing okay. And also, you're only going to have the need for this short period of time. That's not where we are right now. So right now, as a Gen Xer, my dependency ratio is going to be probably 1 in 6 older people. And that's actually that's me right now. I actually do have 6 older adults in my life that I am supporting in various ways, some of which are a bit more chronic, some of which I'm not supporting at all, but I'm keeping my eye out for it. Mm-hmm. And some of which, you know, threw their back out. And that's a real thing that's just happening as we speak right now. That means we have to strategize better. It means we've got to use technology better. It means we need to get better advice in a timely fashion. It means our houses have to be better adapted. And we need to stop avoiding the question. So I don't usually talk about, you know, getting old or whatever. I usually talk about what would happen if you, you know, had a ski accident.
Yeah. Yep.
What would happen if, you know, have you ever thrown your back out? Have you ever, you know, had a concussion? Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. People have had these experiences. So they know what a concussion feels like because they had one playing hockey, right? And they remember how long it took back from. All right. So, you know, now we have a sense of where we can come from. You don't need to be old to think about these things. We can think about them in what if circumstances, and then we can build those what if circumstances to the reality. Sometimes those ifs can take decades.
I'm already brainwashing my kids that they got to take care of me. So if I make
you got two girls, I've got a girl, Trevor's got a girl. We're good. We're golden.
Well, you're doing better. You're doing better because, in fact, as you know, girls and women do make up. It's usually daughters-in-law, which is a big part. So, you know, if you have a daughter-in-law in your relationship, play good real times with them. What I would offer is the gender shift is starting to change. So care is still very much women's work, and I use that term very specifically.
Yep.
But as we are having men not smoke, that's been the big differentiator. So as we are moving out of a generation of lifelong smokers through the generation of I used to smoke as a kid and then I quit to never smokers, those ones are doing better and living longer. So you'll see that, you know, we say, yes, there's many more older women than men. That gap is narrowing. Guys, there's hope for you. But that also means that your chances of being a caregiver are increasing as well.
That's fair. I say I'm treating them well now so that they treat me well.
You know, I hope that works. I remind them regularly. I put an acknowledgement in the back of the book to each of my kids and warned them that I plan on, you know, really being very difficult as I age. And
payback. Eh?
The book is called Let's Talk About Aging Parents. It gets released wherever books are sold on April 30th. This episode is live at on April 26th, so in 4 days you can get this book, just in case people are downloading this or listening to this at different times, because we are on demand. But the final thing, which is very topical right now, and I know we have a tight timeline, so I just want to, maybe do you want to speak on, you know, anything about the recent federal budget and maybe how that affects your job at CanAge or as your CEO on, you know, anything of that nature.
You got to end it on a high note there, eh, Curry?
Nothing like talking about the budget. So the budget, yeah. Look, you know, part of what we do at CanAge is break down what do budgets across this country, whether it's provincial, territorial, whether it be federal, of course, being very impactful in the lives of people. What does it mean? And it was entitled a budget for the generations, or a budget for all ages, a budget for the generations here. But it actually was a budget for young people. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the generations. What was implicit in that was old people, you've had too much stuff. Boomers, you've had too much stuff. Now it's someone else's turn, right? So I actually found the naming of the budget highly problematic to begin. Oh, no. That's not true. I found the naming very nice. I find actually the connection between the naming and what was in it was not so nice. Had it really been a budget for all generations, I think I would have felt a bit better. What I would offer
he's
is
looking this. Politically, right? That's all he's looking politically. That's all what he's
would,
looking at.
Yeah, what I would offer is they have done some really good stuff.
Yeah.
Really good stuff. And so dental is transformative for seniors. A million seniors are being signed up for dental care, and they included dentures, which I can tell you, they said that our work at CanAge actually made the difference on dentures.
Nice.
Pharmacare, like insulin is massively impactful. Metformin, the costs of being a diabetic, which overwhelmingly affect older adults, is an enormous, enormous shift in people's well-being. Those things are really good. They are really trying to do something about long-term care. And what they did was they, you know, supported the development of national standards, and then they have been working, you know, to try to negotiate bilateral agreements, which they did roll out across the country. And some of that stuff has money in it for aging, but it's clearly the province's purview. So have they done some good stuff? Yes. They haven't done enough around vaccines. They need to do more around vaccines. They created a new national housing strategy. It's mostly missing older people in it. As the last one did, we have a national dementia strategy that doesn't do anything. So we're doing badly in that. Now the money. Well, here's what I would say. Look, we are non-political, but I shouldn't say we're nonpartisan, but we're not non-political, right? We'll work with any Correct. Stripe and stream. There are some things I worry about. I suppose the good Canadian in me understands and pays her taxes. And, you know, I take a deep gulp and I write my check and I tell myself that this is going to the betterment of my country. And, you know, I'm really proud when I travel internationally about being Canadian. And if people are saying to me, you know, you have all this stuff, it's like, yeah, I paid for it. Like I paid for it. And what's important to remember is who paid for it the longest? Older adults. And so the narrative that older people are actually somehow taking the bulk of stuff, well, first of all, is actually statistical nonsense. But second of all, if you've paid for it for 80 years, yeah, right? If you have 20-year-olds, they haven't paid for very much. So I actually have a lot of opportunity for people to say, maybe you should sit and reflect about that to begin with, right? And the other important thing to remember is aging is not especially expensive. Illness and frailty are expensive. And that the last 2 years of your life are the most expensive years, no matter how old you are. So if you're, God forbid, 18 years old and you only are living to 20, 18 to 20 is the most expensive years, right? So it's not really about being old, it's about being frail. And so that's why we're trying to reduce frailty. What I worry a little bit around is capital. And I worry about things that stop innovation. And I don't know whether some of the implications around capital gains is going to make Canada as capital friendly as it needs to be. I worry about that a lot.
You're spot on, right? I mean, I've got a corporate held property and we're not selling that thing.
Yeah, I'm worried about that a lot. And I know that as people are thinking about things like how they can use rental spaces within their homes, particularly for folks who work from home, what impact that's going to have on capital gains for their house is one of those areas of significant confusion. I mean, one of the best things they could do, and we've been banging on about this for years, get rid of the mandatory RIF withdrawals. They're nonsense. They were created at a time where the average age of death was 74 and you had to withdraw by 71.
Yep.
Okay, well, first of all, I think you should get rid of it to begin with. Step on. But if you don't get rid of it completely to begin, at least index it. So then you'd have mandatory withdrawals coming at 81. Triple. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's not perfect, but you can't tell people you should work longer, which we desperately need people to do. Massive labor shortage. We're desperate for people to work longer. On average, Canadians will need to work 7 years longer to make up the labor deficit. Okay. And at the same time, we say things, we're going to de-incentivize you by making you pull down money that you otherwise maybe wouldn't want to do at a time. And at the same time, we say we're going to do clawbacks, to stop you. And at the same time, we're going to make it confusing at best. Restrictive at worst, but confusing at best for how is it that you are going to realize that big, hopeful, you know, capital gains of your home. I mean, they keep saying it's not going to affect it. But as people are in middle class looking at maybe they have a cottage and they have a house and they're confused. And what if they claim a section of a bedroom? Does that mean they don't get capital gains, right? Any of that kind of lack of clarity for everyday Canadians is bad for our economy. Things need to be easy to understand. Mm-hmm. And people need to understand that if capital doesn't come to Canada, it means that we're going to have an innovation problem at a time where we need innovation. So I am watching to see what happens, I would say, with encouragement on some of the health stuff, which I think they've really done a superb job on. Frustration that they haven't done better in the pension stuff where they absolutely need to, and some degree of worry about what everyday finance implications are going to have on a downstream capital effect for Canadians.
You're 100% right in saying that everything's focused on the young, right? The whole RRSP withdrawal, the whole first-time home buyer account, right? Like absolutely the bulk of what they've done has targeted that younger generation, right? They've legalized marijuana, right? Like everything.
Oh, actually, though, older adults love marijuana. I have to tell you, that is one of those areas where I would say the boomers on down. It's funny because the boomers are the most addicted to drugs and alcohol of any generation we've ever had and are the most indebted. And with the, you know, we owe a dollar. I'm not a boomer, but, you know, Canadians generally own $1.76 for every $1 that they have, with consumer price indexes not accurately reflecting what older adults need. I mean, our market basket measure, now I'm really nerding out here on financial policy, is based on this idea of a middle-class family with two kids in their, you know, young years. And it doesn't include basic things in our consumer price index. We don't include things like the cost of care or the cost of prescriptions or the cost of those. So the very things that we're talking about that are expensive that we need make seniors' poverty hidden, because the way that we calculate it makes older adults look like they're doing better than they are.
Laura, thank you so much.
Yeah, great topic.
This was, and we would love to have you. We're going to have you on again, 100%, because the 6-part series, whenever that gets written, as your husband, as your partner says, writers write, authors finish. Mm. I like that. Let's talk about aging parents. Miss Laura Tamblyn Watts, thank you once again for being on the show and being our guest. This was a much needed story that needed to be told. So wow. Thank you very much.
Thanks for hosting. It was a delight to chat with all of you today.
Great to have you.
Hondo,
help us. Go. Help you stay informed. Out.